Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Plains on the Prairie podcast. I'm Max.
And I'm Sam.
And we are covering our first World War I Minnesota ace today. And this guy, Brigadier General Martin Stenseth, wow, holy career.
Yeah, yeah. Like we were talking about like the last, with Doyle, Axtell, and Rusom, we couldn't find much.
Yeah, and...
opposite.
Right, yeah. This guy is the complete opposite, and which is kind of funny. This guy obviously fought in the war before those guys, and there is so much information about his life, both, you know, his early life in northern Minnesota and during World War I. Let's just say this is going to be a really interesting episode for you guys. I know we're both really excited to cover his story, and yeah, without further ado, I'd say we hop right in.
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. So Martin Stenseth was born on June 11th, 1890 in Heiberg, Minnesota. So for those unfamiliar with northern Minnesota and the North Dakota region, Heiberg is, I'd say, about, what, 45 minutes east?
Northeast, yeah. If you guys know where Ada Twin Valley is, it's kind of in that area. Yeah,
just before you get into the lakes country, but so, kind of that halfway point.
It's really cool because this is probably one of our closest proximity aces between the North Dakota and Minnesota series that we've had.
So
it's really cool.
It's very cool. So he attended District 37, which was a school in Heiberg, for the early years of education, and then as he got older, actually worked as a log driver in Twin Valley. So obviously, that time period, logging was a major economic source here in this region. And as a log driver, I bet that he was staying pretty busy.
That area, there's a few trees more than around here, so so not a ton, but yeah. And then unfortunately, during his childhood, he was sick a lot. So it really put back his schooling. So he was sent to the McFadden School of Physical Culture in Chicago, which was just one of those kind of hospital schools almost. And that's where he kind of improved his health. And actually returned to Minnesota to go to the Northwest School of Agriculture, which is now the University of Minnesota Crookston, to become a physical education teacher.
Interesting. And it was around 1916, obviously with the war raging in Europe by this point, that he joined the Minnesota National Guard and was deployed to the Mexican border. Obviously, around that time period, you had the Zimmerman Telegram, which was a major concern for the American government. For those unaware of the Zimmerman Telegram, basically, the German Empire radioed or got in touch with their embassy in Mexico, and we're like, hey, you guys should tell the Mexicans to invade South United States, like through Texas, and they it really complicated stuff. But
right, well, and the U.S. and Mexico weren't on the best of terms pretty much for the entire back half of the 19th century. Yeah, I mean, you had the Mexican American War in the 1830s. Mm-hmm. You had the Gadsden Purchase and all these, like, you know. U.S. high school U.S. history kicking in here, but all these you know, concessions that you know, Mexico is making, and you had Pancho Villa in the early 1900s, where, you know, it's just kind of a strained region.
It is, and I it's one of those regions that I'd love to take more time to dive into in a, you know, later podcast, because it's just such a fascinating subject. But so as obviously the United States inched closer to war, Martinus was transferred to the U.S. Army Air Service and commissioned as a first lieutenant on May 13th, 1917, and was assigned to the 28th Aero Squadron in October of that same year. So now we're going to kind of get into where he starts scoring his kills with the 28th. His first kill came against a D7 on September 26th, 1918, over Grimcourt. We should mention a lot of these kills, actually, I think all of them take place over the Western Front in France. So if you've seen 1917, kind of get the picture that that's what was going on the ground. His second and third kill came on this September 28th, so 2 days later, over Grand Prix, where he shot down another pair of Fokker D7s. His third kill came on October 2nd, 1918, over Ivory, where he shot down a Halberstad C-1. Now, I'm not well-versed on World War I German aircraft. Would these have been fair fights to the aircraft that Martinus was flying?
So Martinus was flying mostly SPAD 13s, so the most modern SPAD of the war, and it was probably up there with the SE-5 as the best Allied fighter of the war. The Fokker D-7s arguably are the best airplane or best fighter plane of World War One. You know, you could talk about the DR-1 triplane and other, but the D-7 was more than capable. It served with, you know, nations after World War One for into the 20s.
I remember seeing during the research that in the stipulation that, mm-hmm. like, you know, surrender all arms, all Fokker D-7s had to be turned over.
Yep, the Polish used them, yep. The Russians had some.
I think the Americans tested them
yep.
and flew them for quite some time after the war.
Yeah, and the Halberstadt was an observation plane, so yeah, that one might not have been the most fair if you got the right angle. The tail gunner still was there, you know, right. but Absolutely. If you got lower on them or whatnot. But yeah, he gathered 4 victories within a week. That's pretty impressive.
Yeah, busy, especially in World War One.
Yeah.
That's very busy.
Yeah, so then on October 22nd, so a couple weeks later, he shot down another Fokker D-7 over Ligny Devant Dune.
That's right.
My high school French is a little rusty. And that's where he became an ace.
Awesome. Very cool. Yeah. His 6th kill came on October 29th, 1918. It was actually 2 kills, one against, again, D-7 and another unidentified aircraft. I think the listing just said general enemy aircraft.
Yep.
So it could have been a D-7, could have been a Halberstadt. Unfortunately, we will probably never know.
No.
And then his final victory came just a few days, actually 5 days, before the armistice on November 6th, 1918, which was actually 2 days ago from the day that we're recording this.
Yeah.
This episode, so that's kind of cool. And it was against an unidentified 2-seater over Foray de Wolver. Wow, if you're French,
good try.
Yeah, you know, I tried. He was the highest scoring ace of the 28th Aerial Squadron during the war, which is pretty cool. And he commanded the 28th Aerial Squadron briefly after the war and saw service in the Baltic region of Europe, probably for occupational duties,
yep.
Stuff like that, before returning to the United States. Now, his story doesn't end there. So post-war, he was briefly commanding the 147th Aerial Squadron until it was demobilized and disbanded in 1919. And I believe the 147th shares or has the lineage of the Texas Air National
yes.
Guard. Don't quote me on that, but a lot of these, you know, 100-level aerial squadrons would eventually form into what we know today as Air National Guard squadrons. Kind of interesting, like 1 through, I'd say, 99, 98 are usually reserved for active duty, Air Force. And then you get into the 100s, a lot of those are Air National Guard. And then when you get into, like, the 400 or 500s, those are either Air Force, active duty, or reserve, at least by today's standards.
Sure.
So pretty cool. Again, he commanded another squadron, the 90th Aerial Squadron, along the Mexican-American border. You know, just keeping an eye down there on stuff. And then spent much of the 1920s in Minnesota and Iowa overseeing training for, again, National Guard units. The Minnesota National Guard that he had originally joined was actually the first Air National Guard unit to receive federal recognition after World War One. I believe the Massachusetts Air National Guard was the first squadron to receive aircraft.
Sure.
And they take their slogan is the first in, or either Delaware, no, Delaware was the first state. They claim to be the first Air National Guard, but Minnesota technically has that since they were the first one to receive federal recognition.
Interesting.
Yeah.
You learn a lot from this guy. He's kind of a National Guard nerd.
Yes. Oh, me. Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah, well.
It's a compliment.
Thank you. Thank you, Sam. I appreciate that. So he attended the Air Corps Tactical School at Langley Field in Virginia from 1926 until 1927. Kind of just bounced around multiple bases in the late 1920s. Kind of that gray period. I don't think there was a lot of conflict going on for the United States.
No, and the Air Corps was really downsizing at this point in the mid-war period. U.S. just wanted peace. We were trying to go back to isolationism and stuff like that. But then Stenseth actually went overseas again, going the other way. He went and commanded the 2nd Observation Squadron in the Philippines in the early 30s, most likely at Clark Field. And then after that, he kind of got out at the right time where the war clouds were starting to form in the Pacific. He ended up going back to the U.S. to Randolph Field in Texas in the late 30s and commanded the Air Corps Primary School Detachment of the 52nd Student Squadron. So he's, as you can tell, he's been overseeing a lot of training. Mm-hmm. So and then this was very interesting. We found he was actually attached as an observer to the Latvian Air Force in 1940, pretty much right until the Soviet Union occupied, annexed, whatever you want to call it, of all the Baltic states of Latvia, Estonia, and Lithuania. And then the U.S. figured, oh, you're right there. Let's send you to Finland and be an observer there. So he was an observer in the Finnish Air Force just after the Winter War ended, and then kind of before Barbarossa. So then he took command as the founding commander of the Air Corps Gunnery School in Las Vegas as Lieutenant Colonel, which will soon become Nellis.
Yeah.
Or what has become Nellis Air Force Base.
Yeah, that was something kind of cool. Direct tie-in. I was down at in Las Vegas in early August, and actually was very fortunate to visit Nellis Air Force Base. And it is today. It is very. I've been on a few Air Force bases in my travels, very fortunately, and Nellis is in a league all of its own. Obviously, Nellis is home to Air Force Weapons School, so where pilots train to actually put weapons on targets. And it's also home to the U.S. Thunderbirds. So very high up base within the Air Force structure. And the fact that, you know, small town guy from northern Minnesota was the founding commander of it, obviously not the like the namesake of the base, but it's a really cool connection, something that I think a lot of us northern Minnesotans, northern North Dakotans can take a little bit of pride in.
Exactly.
So he was promoted to full bird colonel in January of 1942, and then promoted to Brigadier General in April of 1943 and was sent to Victorville in California to organize the 36th Flying Training Wing and oversee military and civilian-operated flight schools in the southwest region of the United States. He was then named to the 82nd Flying Training Command Commander in December of 1943 and was relocated back to Las Vegas Army Airfield, again, which would eventually become Nellis Air Force Base. Just reading the notes, this guy really got some miles under his belt.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
he was then relocated from very warm Las Vegas to very cold Iceland Base Command at Keflavik in Iceland from April 1945 until December of 1945. So, you know, just reading that, obviously Iceland was a major stop for aircraft heading to Europe and then during that time period heading back to the United States. You know, you got to think, this guy, when he entered the service, he would have been seeing, Newports and Spads. Yeah. And, by this time, he would have been seeing B-17s, B-24s. Really, really impressive.
Right. And he's seen the U.S. go from an isolationist, almost like considered a second-rate military
to
the superpower. Yeah.
So he was reverted back to colonel. Unfortunately, we don't know the circumstances behind that. Probably at the end of the war, didn't need that many generals running around.
Right.
Reverted to colonel and assigned to Offutt Field in Nebraska in 1946 as the 2nd Air Force Inspector. So he would have been inspecting operational readiness, aircraft maintenance, stuff like that. And his final assignment came at Kelly Field in Texas, where he retired at the rank of Brigadier General in 1950. Again, you know, this guy would have seen early F-84s, P-80s, all of those take flight during his time in the military, let alone his life. Just very impressive. He returned to make his home in Las Vegas, and he would actually summer back in Minnesota, up in the Lakes region. Can't blame him.
Nope.
Very nice. And he passed away on June 23rd, 1979, at the age of 89. So very, very successful military career. Long life.
Exactly.
Considering
yeah.
What he had seen. And by 1979, he would, it gives me goosebumps thinking about what he would have seen, like, take flight in his lifetime.
Absolutely. Well, no flight as a kid.
Yeah, as a kid, airplanes, let's see, 1890. That was before the Wright brothers even flew.
Well, before, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so he had a really, really interesting career. And now we'll kind of segue into a little bit about the 28th Aero Squadron. He was a part of so many units, mm-hmm. but we're going to just focus on the one he became an ace in today. So the 28th Aero Squadron was formed on June 22nd, 1917 at Kelly Field in Texas.
Really?
So he ended where he started.
Yeah.
Really cool. They're initially equipped with Curtis Janford Jennings, the trainer. Little plug, we have a video about the standard J1 if you want to learn the differences between the two. For training purposes, they were equipped with that. And then they were moved to, pardon my French, Vaucouleurs Aerodrome in the Lorraine region of France in July 1918, initially equipping with SPAD 7s, which were kind of starting to show their age, mm-hmm. per se, and then later on to SPAD 13s. So then a few notable actions they've seen is... they were participating in the Saint-Mihiel Offensive and the Meuse-Argonne Offensives in 1918. Just some huge battles. Yeah. You know, 1918 was
really
kind of...
big testaments for the army.
And it wasn't a one war. It was just... these battles were massive. You had the Germans throwing offensives back. I mean, pretty much the entire mm-hmm. back half of the war was like this. They provided primarily bomber escort and air patrols over the lines. And the squadron didn't... last too much longer after the war. It was demobilized on June 16th,
1919. Gotcha. Now, kind of put you on the spot here. Yeah. The 28th Aero Squadron has no relation to the 28th Bomb Squadron of today?
Nope, I didn't see any direct link. Correct me if I'm wrong. If anybody finds that out, we'd love to know.
Yeah,
but
absolutely.
Didn't see much on it. There's, funnily enough, only two aces out of the entire squadron. So Stenseth and another guy who only got 6, and the total victories, I believe the number was around 26. So they accounted for over half of the victories for the squadron. you didn't have the longest, you had July 1918 to the end of the war.
Right.
So you had 3.5 months.
And obviously when you think of Army Air Service squadrons during World War One, you think of the Hat in the Ring Squadron, you think of Luke...
Frank Luke,
and the Balloon Busters. The 28th is kind of that squadron that kind of gets cast to the wayside.
Yeah.
Didn't have that many famous figures. Obviously, Rickenbacker is regarded as
the
ace of aces. Yeah. But still, absolutely fascinating to kind of read more on a squadron that kind of doesn't get the limelight very often.
So yeah, it's really interesting.
Absolutely. So now we will move on to our final segment, which is surviving aircraft. And as all of you can probably expect... World War One aircraft, unfortunately, none of his planes survived today. In fact, there are actually no surviving 28th Aero Squadron marked SPADs in the entire world. Or in the United States, specifically. However, if you do want to see some surviving original SPADs, you can go to the National Air and Space Museum in Washington, D.C., or the National Museum of the United States Air Force in Dayton, Ohio. And then, is it a replica or is it a...
It's kind of a Franken SPAD 13. It's a... the Phoenix Sky Harbor Airport has one that's from multiple SPADs. They're all U.S. marked, I believe. I forget which one. The one at the National Air and Space Museum or the U.S. Air Force Museum has one marked as Rickenbacker.
Yeah, for sure. I was getting confused with the Newport, and I believe the Newport that is on display at the Air Force Museum, I think, is marked as Quentin Roosevelt's, which
okay.
is very fitting.
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, this, and that kind of wraps it up for today, but just to kind of circle back, what a just fascinating character.
Exactly.
This is for sure one of my favorites I think we've ever done. And not just because, you know, the guy had such an incredible military career, but what a life.
Oh, exactly.
Like going from a log driver in Twin Valley to commanding what would become Nellis Air Force Base. Like, that is,
exactly.
From this region. That's right. So cool.
Well, and this is our highest ranked ace so far between the platforms. So
yeah,
no one's reached general yet.
Yeah.
So, again, really, really cool. You know, yeah, you can argue, yeah, because he was a general, he's going to have a good write-up, but that's not surprising. So we're really thankful to be able to find the research. Think, you know, Nellis Air Force Base, their write-up was awesome. There's many other places we found, like his victories on and other things. So kind of refreshing to be able to find stuff, to be honest with you.
I agree, especially after the first, you know, couple Minnesota aces other than Dahlberg, we had nothing. It was kind of unfortunate for us, but this breathed some good life into us, I think, and we're happy that we could tell his story, and
little plug here, where can we expect to see some World War One stuff?
Thank you for mentioning that. We should I forgot to mention this in the beginning, but you guys, the listeners, are really getting an in-depth look, because Martin Stenseth will be one of our featured, not only pilots, but aces in our upcoming, or in the Fargo Air Museum's upcoming World War One exhibit covering North Dakota and Western Minnesota, their contributions to the Army Air Service during World War One. This is going to be a really exciting display. I don't want to spoil anything, but we're working on getting a really, really cool item on loan from Bismarck, the State Historical Society, for the exhibit. And I promise you guys will not want to miss that when it comes here. Hopefully, knock on wood. So, yeah. With that, Sam, anything else to add?
No, I had a lot of fun, and this is six weeks. We've been able to provide a lot of variety here, the Minnesota Aces.
And we should say, we have at least one or two more three Minnesota World War One aces to cover. So obviously we'll switch back to World War Two for a couple more episodes. But North Dakota was a little short, obviously smaller population back then. But expect at least three more World War One aces from Minnesota in the future.
Yeah, and what better day to put this out than Armistice Day, and Happy Veterans Day to all those veterans out there listening, or just if you know anybody, make sure to wish them Happy Veterans Day for all their service and sacrifice.
Absolutely. Amen. So. All right. Well, thank you guys for tuning in this week, and we'll catch you next time.
Yeah, we'll see you.